A sermon by Reverend Richard A. Rem, preached at Christ Community Church in Spring Lake, Michigan, on May 3, 1992, in the series From Proclaimer to the One Proclaimed, entitled Awestruck and Stammering. The scripture readings are Acts 2, verses 29 through 36, and Mark 16, verses 1 through 8. The texts for the sermon are Mark 16, verse 8, and Acts 2, verse 36. Copyright, Grand Valley State University.
Friday and Saturday, the Regional Synod of the Great Lakes of the Reformed Church in America was convened, and I, this year, was a delegate. I am not really much for church assemblies, but one needs to exercise that responsibility from time to time, and so I did manage. I came late and I left early, and I won't be able to give you a full review of everything that happened, but I felt quite good about myself being there as much as I was. But as I was there, I should say that synod is the middle judicatory of the Reformed Church. There's a local district, and then there's a region, and then there's the general level. And we now speak about regional synods. We used to speak about particular synods, and this was the old particular synod of Michigan, for those of you that go back a ways. As I was there, I have seldom felt more strongly the irrelevance of the church. And that's not because the synod does not do good work. In fact, we have some connections with that good work. Keith has been the chairperson of the discipleship division and has served very well. Peter Tooney is presently on that division as well. Our young people attended a youth event recently, the Genesis event, where there were 2,200 young people. Church planning and development, the starting of new churches across the country, is under the direction of Dick Wellscott, who is a son of this church, whom I always think of as my spiritual son, and then I realize he's become my brother. But he's probably the leading person in new church starts in the Reformed Church in America today. And so the Synod actually does some very good things. And what I will say now is not in any derogation of the work of the Synod, but I must tell you that as I sat in those sessions, I was so struck with the irrelevance of the church, not just in that session, but that session as symbolic of what is true of us so often. I opened my nice notebook binder, and there was a page, a title page, with the synod's theme. The theme was, He Will Come. What will we do differently? And there was an hourglass indicating that the hour is approaching, and there was a lion, I suppose the Lion of the tribe of Judah. He will come. What will we do differently? And as I contemplated that theme, I was so struck with the incongruity, with that concern about the fact that He will come, when the real issue in this week, in this nation, is the fact that He has come. What will we do differently? the claim, he will come, and the question, what will we do differently, is so typical of the church. Do you catch it? It is that negative reinforcement and motivation. He will come, what will we do differently? He will come, which sort of says, we had better clean up our act, we had better get serious, we had better get with it, we had better straighten up. He will come, what will we do differently? And as I contemplated in the midst of that session, the church and the present world, I have never been so struck with the irrelevance of being concerned about the fact that he will come. And I have never been struck so strongly with the inappropriateness of focusing on the fact that he will come when what the world is crying out for is our lives to be lived differently because he has come. There were a couple of things, of course, feeding into my dis-ease and my sense of frustration. The one was obviously that Los Angeles was burning, that across this nation, cities were in uproar in the wake of the not guilty verdict in the police brutality case of Rodney King. And as all of that was happening, the church in assembly had as its theme and its focus, he will come. As I sat there and thought about this nation of ours, I was saddened, as I'm sure you were. I thought about my Easter subject, the dawning of a new world, and I said, oh God, where is it? As I thought about what was unmasked again before us, I thought not about them, but I thought about me, and I thought about us. The drugs, the crime that precipitated the evening with Rodney King. The police brutality that issued forth. I thought about our justice system so laced with injustice and inequality. I thought about the poor and the powerless who give vent to anger understandably. I thought about the racism of the nation, of my own, concern to protect position, privilege, and advantage. I thought of those people who would take such an occasion and exploit it for their personal greed and get involved in wanton destruction. And I realized again that we live on such a superficial surface that is only skin deep and that sees underneath, just beneath the surface, sees with potential anger and violence and death, and how all of us can so easily be drawn into that darkness. and into that evil. And one wonders, where is the Easter world? And that certainly was playing on me as I contemplated the Synod's theme. And then I think connected with that was what we have been busy with for so many weeks here, focusing on the way of Jesus and seeing how the way of Jesus and the way that Jesus calls us to follow, that way, the way He proclaimed, calling for a new spirit and attitude and mind and heart because God had drawn near in grace, calling us to be citizens of a new kingdom, to loving our enemies even to that extent, and thinking about the way of Jesus and its relevance to the world a burning. And then there I was sitting in a church assembly with the theme, He will come. And I wanted to stand up and cry out and say, so what if He will come? The point is, He has come. He has shown us the way. It is not, He will come, what shall we do differently? But the point is, He has come. What difference has it made? Oh, I understand the problem of picking themes. I do it all the time, themes and texts for weeks ahead. You just think you got the thing going nicely and you print it in the bulletin and the whole world explodes and suddenly you have nothing to say about what you thought was so important. I thought maybe it would happen to me this morning, as a matter of fact, until I thought a little bit deeper, and then I thought, no, by God's grace this time, what I want to say has all kinds of relevance to what's happening in our world. Our world that is, as I said a moment ago, so volatile, a seething sea, potentially ready to explode. The world that gives us signs of hope. When the Soviet Union unravels and the Eastern Blocs gain freedom and then we find ethnic minorities killing each other. This nation of ours that has so many wonderful things about it, a nation that our president calls us to be kinder and gentler, and you look about you and you see signs for handicapped parking and ramps for wheelchairs, and here and there there are signs of a growing compassion for ethnic minorities, for children, for women. And so one would think sometimes maybe there's some progress, only to experience a week like we've experienced and to know that there is so much entrenched darkness in our society. As I thought about that and I thought about what I wanted to say this morning, I thought what I have to say is entirely relevant to just such a situation as we face. Because you remember what I'm about in this Eastertide season. We have focused on the historical Jesus, the human Jesus, the one who was crucified. We have tried to see His way and hear that call to follow His way. And as I said last week, I sensed that there was some confusion, justifiable confusion, because some of you felt I was bringing Him down too low. I was making Him too human, too much our brother, flesh of our flesh and bone of our bone. And, and you've been nurtured, raised in the church. You have been conditioned to worship Jesus, to pray to Jesus, to adore the exalted Christ, and we speak about true God, true man. And so maybe you begin to feel some dis-ease. Am I talking, when I talk about this Jesus, am I talking about the Jesus Christ of the church's creeds and hymns and liturgies? Well, justifiable confusion. Good question. And so, in this Eastertide season, it will be my purpose to try and show in the development of the church, the early church, how that crucified one became the exalted one, how that historical human brother of ours was exalted to the right hand of God and became the one whom the church worships. And in doing so, I hope that it will become clear to us that it is the human historical Jesus that we need to focus on in our day, and that we have lost that, and because we have lost that, our discipleship is so hollow and our way is so superficial. I want to show you that the crucified one became the exalted one, but never are we done with that one who was crucified. It is that one and that one's way that must be compelling for us. Because otherwise we're just playing a little salvation game. Otherwise we're just another club in town, isolated from the world, with no real relevance to what's going on in the rough and tumble of our society and our day. And so this morning I'm going to continue that process, maybe take the first step in that process to see how the crucified one became the exalted one. And the first thing that I want you to see is that the early church, the early disciples, had an amazing experience. Everything that we have in our creeds and our hymns and our liturgies is a consequence of that initial, overwhelming, incredible, dumbfounding experience. I read from the Gospel of Mark, the 16th chapter. If you have a good Bible, which the Pew Bible is not, the Gospel would have stopped at verse 8, and then you would have had small print after that. Mark 16 has 20 verses, but the last verses, 9 through 20, were added by someone other than Mark. There's hardly a biblical scholar alive that would refute that statement. There are those who say that the last page of Mark's Gospel got lost, that certainly Mark could not have ended his Gospel as it ends in every manuscript that we have, because the 8th verse of that Gospel ends this way, just to refresh your memory. Speaking of the women who discovered the empty tomb, then they went out and ran away from the tomb beside themselves with terror. They said nothing to anybody, for they were afraid. End of Gospel. Now, there was somebody who said, now, we can't have a Gospel that way, and so they added a couple of paragraphs, which are rather similar to what you have in the other Gospels. But Mark's Gospel ends with the women silent, terrified. Well, is it so strange? I mean, have you ever witnessed somebody's death? Heard them cry out in anguish? Saw them breathe their last? And 3 days later, met them alive and well? I mean, that's Easter. That's what we're talking about. The experience. They had no precedent. They had no analogy from which to interpret it. It blew them away. It wiped them out. And at least one gospel says it shut their mouth and they were scared to death. And that's not so hard to figure out. It's very important. One of the important building blocks that I want you to see as we go through this pilgrimage is that it was a mind-boggling, earth-shaking, overwhelming, unsettling, startling, stunning experience. The whole church came out of that kind of phew. And what do you do when you have some experience like that? Well, you run to try to find somebody to listen. And unhappy the person you catch. Because you'll froth at the mouth. They'll have to get their big handkerchief out and probably wipe your whatever. Because you'll be so excited. And how will you explain it? Have you ever tried to explain the unexplainable? Have you ever tried to express the inexpressible? What would you have said? Hey, Peter, just met Jesus. Oh, sure. You know, those folks weren't so different than us. They knew that dead people don't rise. I think I would have been silent too. Well, anyway, the experience was absolutely without precedent, without analogy. And the first thing in the world they would try to do once they sort of came to and pinched themselves was to try and figure out what in the world was going on. What in the world was God doing in heaven's name? They were awestruck and stammering. And one of the earliest attempts to give it expression, we have in Peter's sermon on Pentecost. And there in the second chapter of Acts, in the 36th verse, he says it about as simply as it can be said. Let Israel then accept as certain that God has made this Jesus, whom you crucified, Lord and Christ. That earliest Christology is rather straightforward and simple. This Jesus. No one questioned that this was a real red-blooded, flesh-and-blood human being. This Jesus, whom you crucified, God has made Lord. That is the same word as Caesar, the same word for God, and Christ, Messiah, anointed. God has vindicated His servant Jesus. The way of Jesus was the way of God. And God put God's seal of approval on the way of Jesus by raising Jesus up. Peter was saying, Jesus, now at God's right hand, was given the seal of approval by God in that God raised him from the dead. This Jesus, whom you crucified. No talk here about the Trinity. No talk here about the natures of Christ. What would have happened if we could have stopped with Peter's Pentecost presentation? I wish we could have stopped with it. I wish the gospel hadn't been taken out into the Greek world where we got mixed up with the Greek language and Greek philosophical concepts and all of the philosophical speculation that went on in order to describe how Jesus could be God and God was God and God was Spirit. And how Jesus could be human and Jesus could be divine, all of that philosophical development, which we'll have to come to eventually, could have been spared us if we could have stopped with Peter's presentation. This Jesus, whom you crucified, God raised up. I said last week that earliest formulation, that earliest groping attempt to give expression to the inexpressible is called adoptionism. It didn't prevail in the church. Folks were worried that it didn't say all it had to say. But it was the earliest, it was the simplest, and I would suggest to you that if we could simply go from Pentecost to the present, we probably would have what we need that would serve us better today than all of the creeds that have come in between. Because what we have in this earliest presentation of Peter is that this Jesus, who was a very genuine human being, who walked this way faithful to God, was raised by God from the dead and exalted to God's right hand, and that this Jesus, Lord and King, calls us to walk the way He walked. Maybe, just maybe, we wouldn't lose the human Jesus. Maybe we wouldn't be able to get our focus off from the way He walked. Maybe we wouldn't be able to do what the church did this weekend in assembly. Maybe while the nation burns, we wouldn't be able to say, He will come. What will we do differently? Maybe the church would say, He has come. What difference does it make? I have never been so struck with the irrelevance of the second coming as is presently the case. I, who have stressed Jesus and the resurrection and Christian hope, dear people, the point is, He has come, and He calls us to be as He was. Oh, if the church could have stayed there. Didn't stay there. Pretty soon it began to project back into His story, and then into eternity, and we hit the pre-existent one, and we'll talk about this next week. We've got this heavenly visitor who comes down, dips down, almost touches earth, takes our sin, dies for our sin, goes back. And we simply worship and wait until He comes again while the world goes to hell. The church in its classical formulations has this salvation story. And it gives us such a cuddly, comfortable feeling. We've got heaven assured. The heavenly one came down, took our sin, went back, dropped in, did us good. Now we'll just kind of wait it out. Tread water. Occasionally pray, Maranatha, come Lord. And the world's burning up. I wish we could have stayed with Peter and Pentecost and the Jesus. Gosh, the magnificent Jesus. I'll tell you, I am not trying to say that we ought not to worship at His feet. I am not saying that He is not worthy, the Lamb that was slain, to receive honor and praise and glory and majesty. I am not saying that there ought to be any less worship of Jesus Christ. But I am saying to worship Jesus Christ and not go the way of Jesus is to crucify the Lord anew and to be lost in wonder, love, and praise of the heavenly Christ, waiting for Him to come while the world burns, is to deny Him and to betray Him all over again. And so, it seems to me And it's terribly important that we not lose Jesus, mired in our history, born and crucified in our violent world, raised as the only sign of hope there is, and that we realize that what we are called to do is follow Him, to be like Him. As the prophet said, to do justly, to love mercy, to walk humbly with our God, to extend so much as a cup of cold water in Jesus' name, to be an agent of reconciliation where we can, to summon all the grace possible and even love an enemy. Someone said one day, 2,000 years, same old world, the gospel doesn't work. To which the only possible response is, it's never been tried. Dear friends, there's no reason for optimism. There is only hope in God. And it will be the way of Jesus, or there is no way at all.